ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
I was here on Sunday. Two people. They can't remember what they were doing on Sunday. One honest person. You know what Krishna says in this section of the Bhagavad Gita? Vedaham Vyatitani Janmani Tavacharajuna. That I can remember all of the births, but you cannot. Prabhupada makes the point that you can often ask people, you know, what were you doing at this time yesterday? And they won't remember what it was they were doing. Which is distinct from Krishna's position. Krishna says, I know everything that's happened, both past, present, and future. It's a big distinction. So, okay, hands up against those who remember that they were here on Sunday. Okay, there's a few more now. They've been reminded. Remembrance. Matasmiti jnanam apavanam cha. Knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness comes from Krishna. So sometimes a little coaxing. Alright. What's the type? For those who are here on Sunday, well, for everybody, what is the title of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita? Karma Yoga. Good. Who would like to give us a synopsis of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita? Synopsis means a short summary of the instruction that is given in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Not look, if you have to look at your book, then you're in trouble. Yes, no.
Krishna first talks about how everybody must perform sacrifice.
Yes.
And then we got also just to maintain themselves.
Yes.
And then I think he goes on to say how that, you know, every action that great man performs, common man will follow.
Yes.
And goes on to say how he has to, if he didn't follow the prescribed duty, then he would be the cause of unwanted population.
Yeah, that's good.
And then he goes on to talk about different degrees of lust, I think. That's how he...
Anything before that? Thomas?
Propensity to perform other people's duties and also to become so attached to the reaction.
Attached to the result?
Yeah.
What else?
Just like me, Emma.
Okay. What would you say, if you were to sum up the essence of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, how would you do that? Of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita.
One should do the prescribed duties without fail, and every karma, whatever he is doing, he has to offer it to the God.
Offer it to the God. Okay, yeah.
so that you will be free from all the sins.
It has to be detached.
One has to be detached.
Yeah.
Yes,
detached.
I think that's an important message.
Huh? Don't be attached to the result.
Don't be attached to the result. Okay. Specifically in that last section, where Krishna talks about the living entity being covered by lust.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Why is that important?
Because the reason of birth and death is because of lust.
Yeah.
When sense objects, we come in contact with sense objects, lust are developed.
Yeah.
And from lust, anger arises. Lust, if it's not fulfilled, anger arises.
Yeah.
From anger, the bewilderment of memory, attachment.
Yeah.
From anger, attachment arises.
Yeah.
From attachment, bewilderment of memory.
Yeah.
Then loss of intelligence.
Yeah.
And then again, the living entities become covered again and falls into the material.
What precipitates that discussion? What does Krishna ask?
Krishna says that he, Arjuna says that even if somebody does not want to sin,
yeah,
why is he, like, as an impulse by force, why is he trying to perform sinful activities?
Yeah.
So Krishna says that it is lust only, Arjuna, which is covering the pure knowledge of the living entity.
Yeah.
And he says that this is the way the lust is covering, like a smoke is covering the glass, and, you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's good.
And
you don't have to repeat the whole Bhagavad Gita. I'm trying to get it in synopsis.
I do not know how to say it.
That's all right. Well, yeah. Being concise, I think that's what we want. It's important that... Now, it's important to control lust because of the corollaries, which means basically birth and death. We remain in the material world, lose our intelligence, and we just become engrossed in the pursuit of the satisfaction of our desires, basically material desires. And that comes from lust. And as a result of trying to satisfy that lust, then the end result basically is just repeated birth and death. So Krishna, in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is presenting to Arjuna the means by which one can overcome that influence of the mode of passion and the inclination to engage in activities which are detrimental. So therefore he's going to teach transcendental knowledge in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And the end result, especially in this first section of the Bhagavad Gita, of the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the end result of transcendental knowledge is what? Anybody can tell me? What's the end result of transcendental knowledge, as described in the piece?
Peace.
Let's be more specific. Fourth chapter, text 9. How many people read the section? Not many, I think. I didn't put any homework up. Because that means, no homework up means I was very busy, but also means just read the next section at least. So what does Krishna say? I don't recall anything about, Gatva Mam Shanti Richati. That's elsewhere. I think that's the fifth chapter, isn't it? Becoming peaceful. What does Krishna say specifically in the ninth chapter? Yes, you will return to his abode. So what does that mean? No more birth and death in the material world. So Arjuna is saying, I've been forced to that. Even though I want to engage in spiritual life, I want to do things properly, but yet somehow or other I'm forced to act in ways that I would prefer not to. So Krishna's then, in response to that, he's going to teach transcendental knowledge, by which one can get free from this influence of passion. Right? One thing, that's one thing. The first thing that Krishna mentions in the first three verses, the principle of transcendental knowledge, and it's interesting because this principle of transmission, of giving transcendental knowledge and receiving transcendental knowledge, is an important feature in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, we're in flight mode. If your phone has flight mode, then switch it on. If not, just turn it off. Should turn it off at takeoff. So this is an important point. The transmission of transcendental knowledge. That's what we should be doing as members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Prabhupada mentions in the purport, the first purport, and a couple of other purports in those first three verses, that the Bhagavad Gita was spoken to educate the kings, the Kshatriyas, in order that they would then manage society in such a way so that everybody would benefit spiritually. Because that's the real purpose of human existence, is to understand spiritual knowledge. Spiritual knowledge is critical, or actually spiritual knowledge basically identifies human life. Right? Spiritual knowledge is an ornament, if you like, a decoration that should be carried by every human being. Otherwise, according to the Vedic construct or the Vedic concept, then human beings are no better than animals. Now, where does that put a lot of the population today? They don't show much transcendental, they don't understand transcendental knowledge. They don't demonstrate it. They don't even know it. So, this transmission of the Bhagavad Gita is especially important because it was meant for educating those who would lead society. The leaders of society, especially the Raja Rishis, saintly kings. Which is interesting because, this is just a thought that occurred to me today, was how are we going to ensure that knowledge is understood by the leaders of society? That's the purpose of studying the Bhagavad Gita, and the purpose of distributing the Bhagavad Gita is to educate the leaders of society so that they will lead the citizens in the right direction. And of course, I guess that's our purpose in studying the Bhagavad Gita, is so that we will understand transcendental knowledge, we will put it in practice, and by good example, we can lead the citizens. Right? That's the purpose of, I would have thought anyway, one of the purposes of studying the Bhagavad Gita. And putting it into practice, understanding it, and then giving it to others. So, Krishna then explains, so in the first three verses, Krishna explains this system, if you like, of the distribution of this transcendental knowledge. Text 1. The personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god Vivishvan, and Vivishvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed it to Ikshvaku. And it's interesting. Arjuna understands how old Vivishvan actually is. Right? He's only a few million years old. So in the classes that Prabhupada presents, and more than once Prabhupada says, if I told you that I spoke this knowledge 140 million years ago, you'd think I was crazy. And so for that reason, then Krishna is quizzed by Arjuna in the fourth verse. He asks, how is this possible? But this statement of Krishna reveals a number of very important points. It reveals the age of the knowledge. It reveals the age of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is not a new creation. It is not a new text. It is not a new philosophy. But rather, it's a philosophy that has been extant for millions and millions of years. And again, for this purpose of instructing the leaders of society so that they can order society in such a way so that everybody makes spiritual advancement. So this is a progressive society. It's a society that's freeing itself from the, as Prabhupada says, the clutches of the miseries of material existence, birth, death, old age and disease. This supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. But in course of time the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost. So this is the nature of the material world, in that things manifest and then gradually they deteriorate and they disappear. The spiritual knowledge is transcendental in and of itself, but the teachings from time to time get lost, covered, as Prabhupada points out in the purports in these verses, this verse, the next one. There are people who want to use Krishna's teachings for their own purposes rather than understanding what Krishna's purpose is. And so as a result of that, over time, the message, instead of being transmitted purely through the parampara system, it gets hazy, it gets lost. And so, from time to time, Krishna has to appear to re-establish the religious system. That very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme is today told by me to you, because you are my devotee as well as my friend, and therefore can understand the transcendental mystery of this science. This is important verse. Prabhupada mentions time and time again, one cannot understand the Bhagavad Gita simply by academic
academic merit,
analysis, or whatever. Prabhupada gives the example of a lawyer entering, or shall we say, a student entering into the law, the faculty of law. And he says, at least in India, if you want to enter into the faculty of law, you have to become qualified first by passing an entrance exam. And then when you've, and I think Prabhupada mentioned, that means you have to have graduated, you know, I'm not sure what this was, but anyway, you have to have certain qualifications. So similarly, if one wants to understand the transcendental science of the Bhagavad Gita, one has to have qualifications. But Prabhupada points out it's not academic qualifications that one requires necessarily, but rather here's the qualification that's required to understand the Bhagavad Gita. One has to be a devotee. Now, what does that mean? What does it mean to be a devotee?
Completely surrendered to Krishna.
Completely surrendered to Krishna.
Basically means faith before logic.
Faith before logic. Oh, yeah. Does that mean that devotees are not logical?
To some extent, I would say.
We're illogical.
Complete surrenderance means complete faith.
Yeah, complete faith, but not necessarily illogical. Because the Bhagavad Gita is quite logical. But we don't depend on our logic, if you like. What was it? Complete faith in Krishna. What was that? Completely surrendered. Well, Arjuna wasn't completely surrendered, was he?
But he did.
He
did. He surrendered unto Krishna.
Eventually he did, but there was a lot of doing and frying beforehand. And he understood the Bhagavad Gita.
Didn't he say
after he surrendered, then he...
No, I would suggest, see, because Arjuna is never not surrendered to Krishna, right? But at the same time, he was questioning, as if he had doubts. Here he's questioning. You say that you spoke this knowledge to Vivaswan, the sun god, that he was born 140, or how many million years ago? How is it possible? But is it a fact you have to be totally surrendered to Krishna to understand the Bhagavad Gita?
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
No.
To a certain extent.
But that's, now you've changed your position. It was, you have to be totally surrendered, now it's a certain extent you have to be surrendered.
Yeah, because that was the answer for devotees.
What do you mean by
devotees? Yeah, what am I meaning? For understanding the Bhagavad Gita, you can say that you have to be, till a certain extent, you have to surrender, which includes you have to trust Bhagavad Gita or trust.
Well, that's the faith department coming from here, yes.
So that's one part.
One aspiring for purification.
Yeah, you can be aspiring for purification.
Submissive
hearing. Yeah, because this is explained later on in this chapter, 434. Pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. One has to be humble. One has to be submissive. Submissive. And one has to inquire with the right mood. And then one is required to follow the instructions, to put it into practice, in other words. But I'm not sure whether one needs to be totally surrendered. Of course, one who is totally surrendered will understand Bhagavad Gita. But in the beginning, a devotee is not. And we see that in with the example of Arjuna. He wasn't totally surrendered to Krishna's instructions, at least externally, and so he was inquiring. But because he was inquiring with the right mood, with the right mentality, and then was prepared to put Krishna's instructions into practice, then we can see that Arjuna actually was qualified to understand the Bhagavad Gita. Any comment?
What about daily chanting of Hare Krishna? Is that essential to becoming a devotee?
It's a good It's a good start. It's a good start. The inclination of a devotee is to follow Krishna's instructions. Generally, we follow the instructions of the spiritual master because the spiritual master faithfully represents Krishna's teachings. Right? And those teachings will be fine-tuned or adjusted to time, place and circumstance. Right? Rupa Goswami mentions in the Nectar of Devotion that there are principles. There are certain principles that are required for spiritual advancement. But according to the situation, according to the environment, the cultural setting, according to the nature of the student, according to the potency of the teacher, then the presentation may be fine-tuned, right? The Prabhupada gives the example of the Bible as being the instruction of God. But he also talks about the Bhagavad Gita, or even the Srimad Bhagavatam, as being the instructions of God, but wherein there is a lot more information is revealed, more detail is given. The Bible contains basic ABCs. Right? The Bhagavad Gita gives us the essence of spiritual knowledge, but more that's contained within, say, the Bhagavad Gita. So, you know, the knowledge is revealed according to the receptivity of the hearer or the receiver, and the application of that knowledge may be different according to the... That's why we see different religious traditions. Huh? So, in this particular day and age, it is recommended by the Acharyas that we chant Hare Krishna. Definitely beneficial. Okay, so, what is a devotee? What else is a devotee?
One who understands who Krishna is.
Yeah. Yes. What else?
One who follows the instructions of Master.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else?
I'd like to go back to the root of the word. Devotee comes from devoted.
Devoted. Yeah.
To devote. One who's dedicated in the loving him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that comes back to this point of faith. Having faith in Krishna's instructions and being prepared to put them into practice, not doubting. And of course, the instruction of the spiritual master is designed to remove the doubts. You know, what does Krishna, what does Arjuna say? Sisyasti ham mam tvam. Sadimam tvam papanam, right? Arjuna presents as one who has many doubts. And he was putting himself before Krishna to clear away the doubts. And of course that's where transcendental knowledge comes in. Krishna is speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Vibhishan to instruct the saintly kings so that they will see that the citizens are being instructed in spiritual life to basically clear their path in progressive spiritual advancement. In other words, to remove the obstacles, to remove the doubts. So the qualification for one who can actually do that is one who has faith in Krishna's instructions. He may be inquisitive. In fact, it's actually recommended that one should be inquisitive. And even having doubts is not bad, so long as one approaches the authority to remove them. So therefore the Bhagavad Gita is spoken. the demons will distort and manipulate Krishna's instructions. The devotees will accept Krishna's instructions as they are. And that's the reason why Prabhupada said, I've translated the Bhagavad Gita as it is, even though there are already so many Bhagavad Gitas. Prabhupada mentions, you know, the Macmillan Company told Prabhupada, it's amazing, we're printing other copies of the Bhagavad Gita, but none of them are selling. And your Bhagavad Gita is selling like hotcakes. Because that's because Prabhupada was inspiring his disciples to sell them. But Prabhupada said, we're distributing a new edition, if you like, of the Bhagavad Gita, but it's not our creation or our manipulation or our interpretation, but rather this is Bhagavad Gita as it is. So the demons don't like that. They don't like to hear the Bhagavad Gita as it is. They want to manipulate the Bhagavad Gita or even minimize Krishna's position in order to then relativize Krishna's instructions. Which is one of the reasons why Arjuna is asking Krishna this question. How is it possible that you spoke this knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita to the Bibhishman, the sun god who was born 140 million years ago? Was it 140? I seem to recall 140, but that's... No, here we go. A little bit more than that. 120,400,000 years ago. And in human society it's been extant for 2 million years. Prabhupada says this is a rough history of the Bhagavad Gita. A rough estimate of the history of the Gita. So, in order to have Krishna speak about himself and to establish his transcendental position, then Arjuna asks this question. Because he doesn't have any doubt, as Prabhupada points out. He doesn't have any doubt about Krishna's position, but he's asking Krishna, how is it possible that you spoke? And this really then illustrates the transcendental nature of Krishna's being. Because it's understood and explained by Prabhupada that actually wherever Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita, then Arjuna is with him. Right? In whichever capacity. So even in that situation where the Bhagavad Gita was being spoken to Vibhishthira, Arjuna was accompanying Krishna. And but the problem is that even though Arjuna is present and has heard the Bhagavad Gita before, he can't remember it. Huh? Yet, Krishna says, you and I have had many births. I can remember all of them, but you cannot. There's a difference between Krishna in his liberated position and Arjuna in his liberated position. Arjuna is a liberated soul, Nitya Siddha, a perfect being, right? Arjuna is a perfect devotee. Yet, even accompanying Krishna and having heard the Bhagavad Gita in numerous incarnations, he forgets it. Whereas Krishna, even though Krishna appears millennium after millennium, even though he appears millennium after millennium, he appears in his same transcendental form. His body doesn't change. It's just like, the Prabhupada explains, like a Vaidurya stone. which changes its colour, like a jewel or a gem that changes its colour. So he might appear as Ram in one form and as Krishna in another form, as Lord Nrsimhadev in another form or whatever. But that form is purely transcendental, eternal and transcendental, and not subject to any kind of deterioration. Whereas in our situation, you know, because we're changing bodies all of the time, and our body deteriorates, then we forget. Right? You know, I may have known you when you were a child, and I can tell you that, you know, you did this, that, the other thing. And my parents, there used to be a story go around in our family about how I was 1 or 2 years old and I pulled all of the pumpkins off of the tank and threw them in the well. This is a funny story. And then I got my rocking horse and threw that down the well as well. Now, I can't remember any of that. But it happened. And, you know, my parents tell me, this is what you did when you were a little brat. And so similarly with Arjuna, he's experienced these things, but he's forgotten. Even though he's a liberated personality, he's on the transcendental platform, he's surrendered to Krishna, Krishna's eternal servant, still he forgets. But Krishna never forgets, because his body is eternal. Pretty amazing when you think about it. So he doesn't forget anything. Whereas we're always forgetting, as I mentioned before, you know, we could ask somebody, what were you doing yesterday at this time? And we say, well, what was I doing? I think I was lying down, sleeping. But I can't remember. Maybe because I was asleep. So, this is one feature of the transcendental. This really struck me when I was teaching this section to a group of yogis in Bendigo. I was doing an overview of the Bhagavad Gita, and I was reading this section about the transcendental nature of Krishna. It really struck me how Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna 120,400,000 years ago. And then he's speaking it again. And he's spoken it many times before. And in each of those circumstances, he remembers it, because that's he hasn't changed his body. It may appear on the horizon like the sun. It may appear, the body appears, but it is a transcendental form that never deteriorates. It is just manifest for some time, and then it disappears to our vision. But as Prabhupada gives an example, just like the sun is always there, but just in the morning it appears to rise, and in the evening it appears to set. But the sun is permanently situated in the sky. So, Arjuna is inquiring, how is it possible that you could speak this knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita to Vivasvan? So Krishna says, many births both you and I have passed, I can remember all of them, but you cannot, O subduer of the enemy. There's one feature. Krishna knows past, present and future. Another feature. Ajopi san avyayatma bhutanamishvaro pisan. Text 6. Prakritim swamadishtaya sambhavami yatnamayaya. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. So Krishna appears not like we do, under the influence of the material energy and according to the results of our karma. Right? As a result of our karma, we're born in a particular location and we're forced to act. We're forced basically to be in ignorance. We want to know, what is the purpose of life? Anybody ever wondered about the purpose of life? Yeah? Yeah? Who hasn't wondered about the purpose of life? Yeah. I remember when I was about 4 years old and I walked out in the backyard of our house in Elizabeth and I looked up at the sky and I saw the stars and just the depth of the whole creation. I thought, whoa! What is this place? So thoroughly overwhelmed by the whole thing. Depressed, actually. Depressed. So I think, what am I doing here? What am I supposed to do in this place? What is it all for? You ever thought like that? Mm. Yeah? Probably that's probably why you're here now. So, you know, we're in confusion, but Krishna's never in confusion. He doesn't have any doubt about what's going on, what the purpose of existence is, where he is in the creation and why he's there. He doesn't think that these problems are not the kind of problems that Krishna has. He doesn't have that kind of problem. The Lord says that he appears in his own body. He does not change his body. This is in the purport to text 6. As the common living entity changes from one body to another, the conditioned soul may have one kind of body in the present birth, but he has a different body in the next birth. This is why we forget. We'll be changing bodies. And why Krishna doesn't forget, because he doesn't change bodies. Important concept. Hard to imagine. We're changing bodies all the time. And Krishna doesn't.
When we die and leave the body, we take with us our memory that we form. What does that mean?
Mental. Because as is explained in the Bhagavad Gita, at least as I understand it, The subtle body of the living entity is there are two types of body. We've got the gross material body and we have a subtle body. The subtle body is much like, it's described in the Bhagavad Gita, it's like the fragrance of a rose that's carried through the air. It's subtle, you can't see it. You can perceive it, you can't see it or visualize its form. You can smell it, but you can't see it. And so that, you know, that fragrance, if you like, or that essence of our being, which leaves the gross body when we die, then carries the spirit soul into his next birth. Prabhupada gives the example of the living entity then being placed through the semen of the father into the womb of the mother, and then around that subtle essence, mental essence if you like, of our being, then the gross body, the new gross body then grows again, right? So, you know, in this lifetime you've been living like an angel, right, hopefully, and so then in your next lifetime you will take birth as a demigod, as an example. Or conversely, you've been living like a hog, like a pig, right, and developing the consciousness of a pig, and so then when you die, that subtle essence of your being then carries the soul into the womb of a big mum, and then you find yourself with 12 brothers and sisters, and out you come.
And that doesn't contain memory.
No, yeah, it does. It contains memory because, you know, you wake up and you think, Mommy! I'm hungry! Right? And you know, as a pig, then you're given the facility to enjoy according to your previous desires. And especially, say, if you've been living like if you've developed the consciousness, say, of a demigod, then you get an opportunity to fulfill those desires. Your memory is reawakened as you mature, like in a human form of life. When we're 5 or 6 or 7, you know, we're happy to play in, you know, in the sand pit, right? But, you know, when you're 25 and we take you to the sand pit, we say, oh, let's play with our dinky toys. And hang on, I'm interested in more serious things. Right? I'm driving my Rolls Royce now. I've got a more important toy to play with, for example. So, you know, as you mature and as you grow up, then your desires mature, or your realization of your desires manifests, and then you pursue those things in this lifetime. You may not, you know, it's not.
So with selective memories,
selective, maybe.
You don't recall yourself in your past life,
Krishna. No, you don't remember. Because here's the thing, it's axiomatic that you don't, because if you remember you're not this body and you had another body in your past life, what would that mean?
Another body.
Yeah. You would have some form of transcendental realization, hopefully. You're not the body. I'm not the body. I was this other body in that lifetime. I've got this body in this lifetime, so that means I'm none of those things. I'm something else. So therefore, you know, actually, who was asking that? Sivana was asking that question yesterday morning. You know, why does Krishna make us forget? You know, the reason is because that's what we don't want to remember. We want to think, hang on, well, here I am, this is it, well, I can do it, huh? In this lifetime. We can do it. We can have fun.
The devotee is, what is the subtle, how the subtle body is there, going to go out for the devotee?
No, it's not a subtle body, it's a spiritual body.
But
because it's become purified by devotional service.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't, the material body, both gross and subtle, becomes purified,
mm-hmm.
and returns to its original spiritual element, if you like. The original spiritual element, the spirit soul acts then,
mm-hmm.
on a spiritual platform in devotional service.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, basically the material body just drops, falls away, because it's not material any longer. It's become purified by spiritual engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And but if it's not like fully like that's for the pure devotee, like if it's not that much.
No, it's for everybody.
For the normal devotee.
What's everybody's
like,
a normal devotee?
No, like if the consciousness is not there. No, I'm saying pure devotees. They are
pure devotees. Well. It's for everybody. Otherwise, why bother? That means we're, you know, we're just ordinary devotees, and that means we just have to struggle forever.
Mm.
Only pure devotees make spiritual advancement and go back to Godhead.
Mm.
And for the rest of us, we stay in the material world and just rot. Huh? No, it's for everybody. Devotional. Because, you know, Rupa Goswami says, quote, Atashi Krishna Nama Ina Bhagat Grayam Indriya. You know, devotional service begins with engaging the senses, which are just basically material. We use the material body, which is a vehicle for the soul, right? Basically material. We engage it in devotional service, but devotional service is so powerful that when we practice devotional service, it purifies even the material body. And Prabhupada gives the example of the iron rod. If you get an iron rod, and you stick it in fire and heat it up and heat it up and heat it up. Then when you take it out, it's so hot that it acts like fire. even though it's an iron rod. So similarly also, if we're engaged in devotional service, the reason why Krishna is giving this instruction, to remove our doubts and misgivings, so that we can engage in devotional service, then even the material elements, gross and subtle, become purified, spiritualized. And then in that state of purification, then one reawakens one's spiritual identity, remembers that, as opposed to all of the desires that we might have cultivated or accumulated as a result of our association with the material energy over so many lifetimes. That's the reason why Krishna is speaking this Bhagavad Gita now, and why he's giving transcendental knowledge in the fourth chapter. Because otherwise, what's the alternative? To be distracted by material desires, even if you know that you shouldn't be doing them. And that's a problem for devotees. Actually, that's a problem for devotees. You know, we know that we're supposed to be doing something, but what do?
Material activities.
Huh?
Material activities.
Material activities, yeah. Gratification. Sense gratification. Doodling. Wasting time. Who wasted a bit of time today? Doing something that really wasn't important. Huh? Anybody who didn't fully utilize their day? Satatam kirtayanto mam? Yeah? That's good. Yatantascha dridhabrata. Dridhabrata means, and this is the quality of a devotee, dridhabrata means firm vow. And that's why the spiritual master comes. That's why Krishna is speaking. And why the spiritual master represents Krishna. Because the spiritual master establishes the relationship in the heart of the devotee with Krishna. And the disciple follows the order of the spiritual master in order to re-establish that relationship. And it has to be done with a firm determination. But we do get distracted from time to time. You know, I think only two people here didn't get distracted today. That's pretty good, isn't it? We got two. You know. I want to read. Yeah, whenever he appeared, this is in the purport of text 6. Whenever he appeared, he does so in the same original body by his internal potency. In other words, Krishna appears in this material world in his original eternal form with two hands holding a flute. He appears exactly in his eternal body, uncontaminated by this material world. Although he appears in the same transcendental body and is Lord of the universe, it still appears that he takes his birth like an ordinary living entity. And although his body does not deteriorate like a material body, it still appears that Lord Krishna grows from childhood to boyhood and from boyhood to youth. But astonishingly enough, he never ages beyond youth. What's that? What's that?
He doesn't grow old.
Doesn't grow old. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? At the time of the battle of Kurukshetra, he had many grandchildren at home, or in other words, he had sufficiently aged by material calculations. Still, he looked just like a young man, 20 or 25 years old. So how would you like to look 25 at 125? What do you reckon? Go for that? Everybody's nodding. Pretty cool. We never see a picture of Krishna in old age because he never grows old like us. Although he is the oldest person in the whole creation. Remember, he doesn't change his body. Krishna doesn't change his body, so he's Puranam. He's the oldest, but Navayovanam, always freshly youthful. That's amazing, isn't it? Actually, even as a devotee, I remember I was doing book distribution in some flats in Caulfield, and I was talking to a gentleman, and I asked him how old he was, and he said, "Oh, I'm 75. I said, "Wow, that's pretty old." He said, "No, I'm not old. I'm one of the young ones around here. There's people who are 95 here. I'm 20 years younger than them." I'm one of the young guys. And so I asked him, I said, "Well, how do you feel?" He said, "I feel about 16. I feel about 20 years old." So, you know, when you're, at least on a good day anyway, when one's not plagued by all of the miseries of material existence, then one feels youthful. That's our that's our natural position.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're chanting Hare Krishna and we're in elevated Krishna consciousness, that's how we feel, enthusiastic about life and vibrant, youthful, enthusiastic. So Krishna is, he demonstrates that. That's how he always is. That's how we should always be too. If we can identify not with the body, but with our spiritual identity. He never grows old like us, although he is the oldest person in the whole creation, past, present and future. Neither his body nor his intelligence ever deteriorates or changes. Therefore it is clear that in spite of his being in the material world, he is the same unborn, eternal form of bliss and knowledge, changeless in his transcendental body and intelligence. That's something to meditate on. The nature of Krishna's form. Now, the reason for his appearance is, whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, I descend of Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. So he's explaining his transcendental position, and this is part of transcendental knowledge. Very important. These are elements of transcendental knowledge. Knowing Krishna's form to be what it is, that it's eternal, that it never changes, that it is never covered by any form of ignorance. This is one of the reasons why this transmission of transcendental knowledge is so important, and that it be done faithfully, because Krishna's instructions are infallible. They have no fault. And whereas material knowledge is all relative. And because it's gathered by imperfect senses, because we are subject to illusion, you know, material knowledge is faulty, basically. Prabhupada gives the example, we look at the sun and it looks about this big in the sky. Huh? It's small, really. Of course, when you try and look at the sun, then you realize how potent it really is. Extremely powerful. When you think about it. The sun is extreme. And of course, Krishna says, you know, the sun and the moon are my eyes. So you, when you look at the sun, you get a hint of Krishna's potency, power. Extremely powerful. But at the same time, that's a bit little, it's illusion, it's so, Krishna is unborn, yet he appears to be born. His body never deteriorates, yet it appears that he disappears. The mystery of Krishna's appearance, right? Although he is the Lord of everyone, still he appears to take birth just like an ordinary living entity. But Even though he appears to take birth as an ordinary living entity, actually we can see by his characteristics, his activities, his pastimes, that he's not an ordinary person. He never gets old. And this is all taking place under the control of Krishna's spiritual potency. It's very, very special, Krishna's activities, his appearance, his pastimes, all of these things, and his instructions is all imbued, endowed with spiritual potency. Why does he do that? Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, I descend in the Bharata, and the predominant rise of the religion, at that time I descend myself. So Krishna appears for a purpose, and that purpose is to Pavitranaya Sadhunam Vinashaya Sadhusprittam, to please his devotees. Even though his devotees are always transcendental and above the material platform, still they're in anxiety. Why? Because they want to see Krishna. Tired. Working hard, looking after your son. Huh? Yeah. And husband. Got two boys in the family. Krishna's devotees are in anxiety, in expectation, in hope that they will see the Lord. And so therefore Krishna appears to satisfy his devotees. And reason, Paritranaya Sadhanam, to protect the devotees, or to please the devotees, to give shelter to the devotees, to satisfy the devotees. That's why Krishna appears. And, you know, in the process, kill a few demons. Have some fun. Huh? Which also pleases the devotees. The devotees don't get upset, oh, Hiranyakashipu Poo got killed, oh. Hiranyakashipu, kill him! You know, this was evidence used in court about what a brutal religious system we have. We get pleasure in seeing our parents get killed. The demons, kill the demons. Of course, what's not understood is that actually the demons get benefited by being killed by Krishna. It's not. Whether Krishna is kissing or killing, its benefit is the benefits there. And you know, the real purpose of somebody's phone is snoring. They're horrible things, these phones, aren't they? I was in India, and it was like about 2:30 in the morning. Usually when I'm in India, I turn my phone off. Because, you know, somebody in Melbourne or in Sydney, you know, it's 9 o'clock or 9:30 in the morning, they say, oh, yeah, let's ring up Andy Ruda. No, it's 3:30 in the morning or 2:30 in the morning.
I have a question. Did the Kshatriyas at the time of Arjuna consume meat?
I don't know. Possibly.
Okay, and secondly, even if people...
Are you a Kshatriya?
I'm not sure.
Not sure. Anyway, even if you are, in this day and age, not recommended.
Not recommended.
Yeah. Wouldn't worry about what they did in those days. But certainly in this day and age, definitely not recommended. And we can assume that, you know, even if there was some system for, you know, sacrifice and eating of meat, still the sages and saintly persons wouldn't engage in those type of activities. Might have been some prescription allowed for the Kshatriyas, but, you know, there's nobody amongst us who fits into those, that category, really, of real Kshatriya. Special personalities. Anyway, go on.
I was just curious, regarding the transcendental life.
Yeah.
Even if somebody is reborn as an animal.
Yeah.
Why really bother? Like some.
Why do you bother?
Why do you really bother, even if someone is reborn? It hardly makes any difference. Like if you say yes, even some pigs have better lives than some humans, he says.
Whereabouts does your family live?
They live in India.
Yeah, I know. Whereabouts?
In Delhi.
Have you got pigs in your neighbourhood?
No.
No. But you have seen pigs.
But
I do
sometimes indulge in overeating though.
Yeah, you have seen them, haven't you? You do see what the pigs live like. Yeah. I know what I would prefer to live like. And I probably would prefer not to be a pig. Even a pig living in a pigsty is not very pleasant. But anyway, you know, some people say that quite frankly. You know, what's wrong with being a dog? Just sit around the backyard, you know. Somebody brings you meals two times a day, take you for a walk, run around the block, sniff a few things. Pass water on anything you like. But that really is the mode of ignorance, when you think about it. For a person in the mode of ignorance, then being in the mode of ignorance is appealing. But for a transcendentalist, when they see the behaviour of a dog and his activities and his consciousness, the development of his consciousness, and they can see that actually he's not utilizing his full potential. He's covered. His consciousness is covered. His knowledge, original knowledge, his original spiritual identity is covered. So it's not attractive for a transcendentalist. It's ignorance. And and because it is ignorance, then it's suffering. Now, even a dog, you know, when I was a kid, I used to have a dog. And if you look at the dog, he's always good. He's always not getting what he wants. Have you noticed that?
And how do you explain the human suffering part?
Well, because we're behaving like dogs, then we suffer like dogs. In one sense.
Don't dogs have disease, nobody is there to treat them?
Dogs? Oh, look at the dogs in India.
I mean,
some dogs in India think, how is that poor fellow staying in his body? he's just got sores all over his body. Every other dog, when he walks by, they just all pick on him and jump on him. Horrible. And then he runs off with his tail between his legs. There's no way being a dog. No, you know, in Australia, I couldn't see. I used to hear Prabhupada give these lectures and you know, talk about the life of the dogs. And I said, what's Prabhupada talking about, you know? Dogs in Australia, you know, they get taken for a walk and people pick up their poo. And, you know, they get served, right? And then I went to India and I saw what the dogs are like there and I thought, wow, this is what I mean. And the quantity of dogs that live in a country like Australia is pretty few. The lucky dogs are pretty few. They're really suffering, unlucky fellows. And you know, if you're living in China as a dog, well, basically you're going to be somebody's dinner. So, I think on the odds of it all, the chance of being a lucky dog is pretty slim. But even if you are, it's still suffering. I want to finish off. to deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, as well as to re-establish the principles of religion. I myself appear millennium after millennium. And this is the point, that the Lord appears in order to teach transcendental knowledge, basically. Main purpose for appearing. That's why the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. The Bhagavad Gita was spoken to give transcendental knowledge. Sometimes Krishna reveals more information, sometimes he reveals less information. You know, depending on the audience. But that's his purpose. To protect the devotees, to destroy, but to establish religious principles, to establish transcendental knowledge, so that people will be benefited. And in the last verse, verse 9, we see, what's the result of receiving transcendental knowledge? One doesn't have to take birth again. Janma kama cha me divya yo me evam yo veti tattvataha chakva deham punar janma nayati mameti sorvina. So giving up this body, chakva deham punar janma na. If you understand transcendental knowledge, then you don't have to take birth again. This is the purpose. The purpose of distributing transcendental knowledge is to stop people taking birth again. Whereas, as Arjuna said in the beginning, why am I forced to act? It's because of lust. And as a result of lust, then one has to take birth again in the material world. So the whole purpose for giving transcendental knowledge is to free people from to know Krishna, and as a result of knowing Krishna, then to free people from the reactions of their material existence, and to engage basically in devotional service, to engage in activities that are transcendental to the actions and reactions of the material world. Does anybody have any comments or questions on any of these points? Yes.
From a bit earlier, when Arjuna, he always forgets Bhagavad Gita, and is it right that he's transcendental?
Even though he forgets the Bhagavad Gita, still he always engages in Krishna service.
So my question is that Yogamaya?
Is it Yogamaya?
Yes.
Why not? Yes, Arjuna. Even when Arjuna is refusing to follow Krishna's instructions, that's actually according to Krishna's desire. So the thing is, when Arjuna's in Maya, he's actually not in Maya. He's acting according to Krishna's, Krishna's plan. So it's Krishna's plan that Arjuna become bewildered. Because we were discussing, I don't know if you were here with us then, but we were discussing. And one of the reasons why I really enjoyed the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita this time was because we were looking at that verse which described Arjuna as Budakesh, which means the conqueror of sleep, which indicates, no ignorance. And yet he was he was acting as if he were in ignorance. But as Prabhupada points out, that covering, so-called covering of ignorance, was actually an arrangement of Krishna, so the Bhagavad Gita could be spoken.
So Arjuna is sort of in the spiritual world having this eternal pastime of forgetting and then spoken to him.
Forgetting and remembering.
And not remembering, but having it spoken to him. And
yeah, I guess so. Seems to be that way. That's his service. One of his services is to have the Bhagavad Gita spoken to him and then he forgets it. Not like us. We get the Bhagavad Gita spoken to us and we really do forget it. He gets the Bhagavad Gita spoken to him, he forgets the details, but he remembers the essence. And so he still engages in Krishna service. Even when he's forgotten the Bhagavad Gita, he's still engaging in devotional service. Whereas we forget the Bhagavad Gita and don't engage in devotional service. Big difference. Similar, but different. Whereas, yeah. Yes, come on.
If we study the Bhagavad Gita and we read the essence, it comes into our conscious mind.
Yes.
So it can be remain in our subtle intelligence, you can say, or mind.
It can also disappear, as we've noticed. Yeah. That's why it's recommended that we regularly hear the Bhagavatam, regularly hear the Bhagavad Gita, so that it does remain in our consciousness, deep within our consciousness, and full up. You know, there's the example of a cup of milk. If you fill up a cup of milk half full, and then get some ink and pour it in, what happens? Huh? We get blue milk. We get a grey. But if you fill your cup all the way up to the top with milk, then get some ink and pour it on top, what happens? Anybody ever seen this experiment done?
Lightly blue.
Lightly blue. No. There used to be a fellow on TV called Julius Sumner Miller. You have to be about my vintage to remember. He had a show called Why Is It So? And he would do experiments like that. If you get a glass and you fill it up with milk and then pour ink on top, but you fill it right up. And see, what happens is then you get what is called a meniscus, and it's a concave meniscus, which means it goes like this. So that when you pour another liquid on top, it immediately falls over the side. As you get other liquids which create a convex meniscus, which goes like this, and you can pour stuff in and it'll go in. So the example is given. If you fill your cup, your mental cup, right up with Krishna all the way to the top. Right? And that's why hearing every day is important, because we keep topping our consciousness up with Krishna. We chant Hare Krishna in the morning, we hear the Srimad Bhagavatam, we study the Bhagavad Gita, and we do that continuously, then we fill our consciousness up from the top to the bottom with Krishna. Occasionally, you know, because we're in the material world, we'll get disturbances. You know, like sometimes on the bottom of a pond, you'll have very, very clear water, and then all of a sudden there'll be a bubble and some disturbance, and then some murk and mud will come up and it'll get murky. Gradually it'll then settle down again. So occasionally, we'll still get a few disturbances. Right? But if we keep pouring Krishna in, then eventually it all fills up, and then all we do is think about Krishna.
So this means that whatever the endeavor I will be doing to some extent, 10% or 20%, the next life it will not be carried on. As Krishna
it will be carried on. Prabhupada mentions that the reason why we are carrying on devotional service now is because we performed devotional service in a previous lifetime. Obviously it wasn't enough. So we need to keep it up. And what happens when you don't? What happens if you don't keep up topping up the tank? What happens?
Run dry.
Empty. Yeah, or Bebopalula. At least for me anyway. You might not know what Bebopalula is, but it's an old 50s hit. So the jukebox of the mind starts replaying, you know. For you it'll probably be Hindi movies. Huh? I got an Indian phone. I was trying to find a decent ringtone. So we went on the Reliance website looking for a ringtone that I might like, you know, and it was all just Hindi movie tunes. Of which I couldn't understand anything. But then I asked Woody Munters, what's this, what's that? I said, oh yeah, yeah, that's the movie from... So that's what happens. Our past memories of material life come back. But if we absorb ourselves in Krishna and keep on top of it, then our spiritual memory gets revived and that comes back. That's what we want. Huh? But it requires constant input. So we have to be reminded. We have to keep pouring it in. And even sometimes when you think, oh no. No more Krishna. Give me some Bebopalula. That's really bad. Let me listen to something. That's what we have to watch out for. That's the bad attack of Maya.
How are we supposed to go about learning the shlokas that we need to learn?
It's called repetition.
Is there a list of them, though?
Yeah, there's a list of them in your handbooks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 27 verses, which you'll be tested on every one of them. So if you want to get full marks, learn all the verses. What you can do is you can get some little cards, write out the verses on the cards, and you know, just carry them around one, and then just keep repeating. How do you think I learn? It's by practice.
So where are they in the book there?
It's in the student handbook. In the student handbook. And it's page, I don't know, 11, 12? 75. There you go, thank you. Yeah. And you can learn them, it's not difficult to do it, it just requires practice. Did you learn your times tables?
Yes.
Yep. If I ask you what 8 times 7 is, what is it? 42. Yeah. You might have some problems when you do this. Alright, I think we should finish. I'll put some homework up tomorrow.